Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association.
This is episode 77 of Text Messages, Resilience Literature. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. Young adult literature has long been criticized for being too dark. Since the earliest days of the field, parents have worried about the messages young adult novels send teens. They're still worrying today. On the pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times, articles condemning young adult literature appear on a regular basis. Again and again, adults who aren't knowledgeable readers of YA tell us that these books are depressing and bleak. Usually they go on to argue that reading YA will hurt young people. Teens will develop a negative view of the world, or they'll be encouraged to wallow in misery. We need to get away from this negativity, the articles say. We need a literature of hope. It's true that many YA authors choose to write about difficult topics. Violence, abuse, and trauma are never easy to stomach, in literature or in life. Books on these subjects strike some adults as extreme. Nobody's life is that bad, they argue. And yet, if you talk to adults who actually work with teens, you soon learn there are plenty of young people living the very situations we see depicted in YA Lit. These teens deserve stories that tell the truth about their experience. But so do teens whose lives are more sheltered. Literature can help us feel seen and understood. It can also teach us to feel empathy. But there's yet another possibility, and it's one that typically gets less attention in conversations about the value of reading. Literature can show us how ordinary people cope in the face of struggle and pain. Instead of looking down on young adult literature, or worse, preventing teens from reading it, we can choose to think about these books in a different way. Not long ago, YA author Lori Holtz Anderson gave us the language to do so when she began talking about resilience literature. It's a term she picked up from an English teacher who taught her book Speak. Lori uses resilience literature to describe YA titles that explore tough issues teens deal with every day. Typically, we call these books contemporary realistic fiction, but Lori's label highlights their power to help readers overcome all manner of obstacles. In an interview with teen librarian and book blogger Kelly Jensen this past spring, Lori said, "Resilience is the quality that I hope all teenagers can develop so that they're ready when the world comes at them. Literature is a fantastic way to learn about the kinds of hardships you may have to deal with. Watching characters grow and change is a great way to strengthen yourself for your own challenges." Over the past couple of months, I've been on the hunt for books that fit Lori's definition of resilience literature. In this episode, I'll introduce you to what I've found. You'll hear about teens who are dealing with death, violence, trauma, and prejudice. Odd as it may sound, some of the books are funny, albeit in a quirky, wistful way. Others are suspenseful page-turners. What they all have in common is a main character who finds him or herself in a terrible situation, but finds a way to respond with strength and hope. The first set of books I want to tell you about feature teens dealing with traumatic losses. Here, resilience means both mourning a loss and living with guilt. In The End or Something Like That, a new novel by Andy Ellis, main character Emmy is coping with the death of her best friend, Kim. Before she died, Kim made Emmy promise to contact her in the afterlife. Together, they went to one of those workshops where a celebrity psychic insists that the veil separating the living and the dead is thin. Your dearly departed loved ones are right there waiting to communicate with you, if only you will ready yourself for their visits. Emmy isn't sure she believes this, but she didn't believe Kim would die either. Now, in the aftermath of Kim's death, the promise of a visit from the afterlife is the one thing Emmy has left to hold on to. On birthdays and anniversaries, Emmy waits for Kim, but Kim doesn't show up. Strangely, though, other dead people do. Emmy's earth science teacher, a boy from school who died on a roller coaster ride. What do these people want with Emmy? And what do they have to teach her? There's so much to say about the texture and mood of this odd and lovely book. The narrative voice is quirky and original. Certain lines and details will make you laugh, even in the context of circumstances that are extremely sad. The book's structure is complex and inventive, with a handful of chapters that are just one sentence long, and a plotline that flips between past and present. Most important, the emotion of the story, as portrayed through Emmy, is heartfelt. Emmy is grieving not just the loss of Kim, but the way things went wrong between them before Kim died. It was middle school, and Emmy had begun to feel left behind by Kim and betrayed. Healing for Emmy is about grieving the loss of Kim, but it's also about forgiving Kim and herself, and finding reasons to believe that life is still worth living. Another new novel exploring death, grief, and guilt is I Love, I Hate, I Miss My Sister, written by French author Amélie Sarn and translated into English for publication in the US. Here the main character is Soan, and the tragedy is the death of her younger sister, Jalila. But Jalila's death is not ordinary. It's a hate crime. Muslim boys who disapproved of the way Jalila dressed, played sports, and flirted first stalked and harassed her. Then they spit at her and slapped her face. They called her a whore and a disgrace to Islam, but Jalila refused to change. So one day after school, they forced her into the basement of their housing project. They set her on fire. She burned to death. What makes this tragedy unbearable for Soan is the guilt she carries. Secretly, she too disapproved of Jalila, even as she loved and envied her. Secretly, she thought Jalila would get what she deserved for flouting the religious teachings they were raised with. As Jalila became more carefree, Soan became more devout. So when she saw the boys harassing her sister, she did nothing to stop them. Now she has to live with the burden of wondering what might have happened if she had intervened. Based on a true story, I Love, I Hate, I Miss My Sister will prompt important conversations about female sexual identity and violence against women. It will also raise questions about the treatment of Arabs who want to practice their religion in secular environments. At the same time Jalila was claiming her independence by dating and expressing her beauty, Soan was doing the same by choosing to wear a headscarf to her public school, even though French law forbade it. Resilience for Soan means healing from her sister's death, but also holding on to her identity and dignity in a society that would prefer to erase it. A third new book that explores how teens struggle to heal after violent tragedy is And We Stay by Jenny Hubbard. After main character Emily's boyfriend Paul comes to school with a gun and threatens her with it, and then uses it to kill himself, her parents enroll her in an all-girls boarding school in Amherst, Massachusetts. She doesn't want to go, but her parents insist that she needs to get away from the whispers and stares and the memories of all that went wrong with Paul in her old life. In her new school, no one knows her, and no one knows what happened with Paul. Emily is weighted down by guilt over Paul's death, but we don't know why. We do know that she finds solace through writing poetry. Poems possess her. They burst in her brain and demand to be written. At her new school in Amherst, poetry is Emily's lifeline. Soon she is reading poetry as urgently as she's writing it. She knows that Emily Dickinson graduated from the school she now attends. When she pulls a volume of Dickinson poems from the shelf in the school library, something about those poems lodges inside her. Soon she is wandering through the town, lingering outside the Emily Dickinson house, and wondering what that other Emily's life was like. What secrets did she carry? What ghosts possessed her? In a story layered with flashbacks, readers learn about the slow unraveling of Emily's relationship with Paul. The more we learn, the more we understand the guilt she now carries. Poems, plus the ghost of Emily Dickinson, are her path to healing. Like Jenny Hubbard's first novel, Paper Covers Rock, And We Stay is an extremely literary book. It's a thoughtful and introspective look at how writing can help people survive. The next set of books I want to tell you about depict the struggles and resilience of boys. Based on the cover and the premise, Andrew Smith's Winger doesn't look like a work of resilience literature. It too is a boarding school book, and it's one that foregrounds sports, in this case rugby. The cover image of a prep school kid with stitches over his eyebrow and a bloody nose led me to tag it as a book about jocks and bullies. But main character Ryan Dean is not your ordinary jock, and he's certainly no bully. Yes, he's a talented member of the rugby team, but he's 2 years younger than all of his classmates, so he's constantly trying to compensate for feeling too small and too smart. He's in love with his best friend, Annie, whose hotness is always at the forefront of his mind. She's 2 years older, just like the rest of his classmates. That means that most of the time when Ryan Dean is with her, he feels like a scrawny little boy, or maybe a beloved pet, but he lusts after her anyway. So Ryan Dean has some challenges, but so do many of the boys at Pine Mountain Academy. It's a place where there's always posturing going on in a masculine pecking order of toughness. Even though the rugby players are expected to be loyal to each other, you can sense a current of hostility running just beneath the surface as they jockey for power and trade homophobic insults. Even though we can laugh at how Ryan Dean feels like a loser, and he encourages this with his self-deprecating humor and the comic illustrations he draws about himself, it's scary to contemplate what angry boys are capable of. I can't say more about Ryan Dean's resilience without spoiling the story, but know that Winger is very much a coming-of-age novel. It's one that succeeds because Ryan Dean is such a great combination of smart, honest, loyal, insecure, and confused. He's a really good kid who's doing the hard work of figuring out who he is within a larger story arc that is funny, tender, and sad. Another book featuring funny and vulnerable teenage boys is Jason Reynolds' new novel, When I Was the Greatest. If Winger brings us into the privileged world of a wealthy boarding school, When I Was the Greatest takes us into the streets of Brooklyn and the lives of three kids who hang together in the neighborhood. According to main character Ali, it's not the best block. Plenty of white people might be moving to Brooklyn, but there's none on his street. According to Ali, even black people don't want to move there. But for a kid like Ali, it's not so bad. He stays away from the guns and the drugs. He's got his mom, who keeps him on a tight leash, and a little sister who adores him. And he's got his friends, a couple of brothers who live next door where the scene's a little scarier. Ali calls their building the Death Trap. It's a slum full of junkies and hookers, and their mom is really not around. But Ali's mom is, and she looks after the three of them. As Ali gets to know these boys, so do we. There's Noodles with his comic books and his tough guy posturing, and there's his older brother, Needles, with his freestyle rapping and his sudden profane outbursts. Ali's mom explains that Needles can't help his outbursts. He has a syndrome, Tourette's syndrome. After an incident where Needles has a particularly wild fit and draws a mocking crowd, Ali's mom runs up to their apartment. She comes back down with a pair of knitting needles and a ball of purple yarn. Slowly and calmly, she teaches Needles how to knit. And just as she predicted, the knitting calms him. You'd think Needles would be the problem in this story, but really the problem is Noodles. With his big mouth, his tough guy attitude, and his idea that the rules don't apply to him, Noodles is trouble. But Ali understands that all of Noodles' posturing is just a cover. The question is, what's going to happen when Noodles finally goes too far? If you have middle grade readers in your life, and especially if those readers are boys, you're going to want to track down a copy of When I Was the Greatest. The street smart dialogue is great, and the characters are ones you'll care about. Beyond those story elements, it's important for readers to see young teen boys navigating real dangers in urban neighborhoods, but not without a safety net. Resilience is easier to summon when there are wise adults around who have your back. On a different note, sometimes the problems in teens' lives don't stem from anything teens themselves have done. Rather, their need for resilience is a consequence of something broken in the life of an adult. This is true in the next two books I'm going to tell you about, both of which are dark and suspenseful page-turners. The main character of Stephanie Keen's novel, Charm and Strange, is a boy with two identities. In chapters labeled Matter, he is Wynn, a teenage loner at boarding school in wooded Vermont, depressed, fearful, starving himself. In chapters labeled Antimatter, he is Drew, back in his Virginia childhood, a tennis prodigy with a penchant for violence. At age 9, when he lost an important tournament, he cracked his opponent across the face with his tennis racket, and then he cried. There's clearly a story there about the dark moods and rages of his university professor father, about his tired, absent mother, about the siblings who surround him and protect him. Even as a child, Drew hates himself. Am I hunter or hunted, he wonders during a family visit to a wolf preserve. As readers, we don't know enough to guess the answer. Years later at boarding school, Wynn is still asking that question. A classmate has been found dead in the woods. His siblings, we come to find out, are dead too. Wynn's science teacher wants to talk to him about quarks, those tiniest components of the universe, composed of matter and antimatter. Somehow, Wynn's existence is like these quarks, balanced on the border between creation and annihilation. What is the nature of the violence inside him? What is the source of his self-hatred and shame? Readers who enjoy mystery, suspense, and psychological complexity will be riveted by Charm and Strange. The slow reveal of Wynn's family story is difficult and haunting. The more we get to know Wynn, the more we come to understand that what's at the core of him is pain. As much as any book in this show, Charm and Strange asks how wounded people are able to heal. This is a hard book to read, but it's also darkly beautiful, and it's rich with metaphor and feeling. Librarians thought so too. For its originality and innovation, Charm and Strange was the winner of last year's William C. Morris Award for debut work of young adult fiction. Another outstanding mystery that will reward older readers with its page-turning intensity is Lucy Christopher's new novel, The Killing Woods. When the story begins, main character Emily's father emerges from the woods carrying something. At first, Emily thinks it's a deer. Then, in horror, she realizes it's a person, a girl, someone she knows, Ashley Parker, a classmate, the girlfriend of Damon Hillary, one of the most popular boys in their school. Her father's in one of his wild-eyed states, wheezing, trembling, and incoherent. Emily can see that he's having a flashback. He gets them often, triggered by the memory of killing a civilian during his time in the war. He's been broken ever since. Now there's a girl in his arms. She's wet and bruised. There are marks around her neck. She's dead. At the hearing 8 weeks later, Emily's dad pleads guilty of manslaughter. He thinks he must have killed Ashley in the midst of a psychotic flashback. Emily can't allow herself to believe this, but what other explanation is there? Damon Hillary knows there's more to the story. He and his friends were also in the woods on the night Ashley died, but they're not admitting it, at least not in public. And so the suspense begins. In parallel narratives, Emily and Damon each try to piece together enough clues and memories to uncover the cause of Ashley's death. The need for resilience runs deep for both of them. Figuring out what happened to Ashley requires looking inside themselves and asking what they each are capable of. What secrets might they be keeping, even from themselves? As a study of human nature, The Killing Woods is masterful. I couldn't put it down. I love the ambiguity in the characters and in the storyline. The more deeply Emily and Damon probe Ashley's death, the more entangled they become in each other. Readers who enjoyed Lucy Christopher's Prince Honor novel, Stolen, will not be disappointed by this worthy follow-up. The last two books I want to tell you about feature older teen girls who find themselves in circumstances that test their character. In these novels, resilience comes from developing the strength they need to chart the course of their own lives. The newer of the two, Like No Other by Una LaMarche, features a main character named Devorah who isn't looking to change anything when she shows up at the hospital for the birth of her sister's child. She's an obedient daughter in a strict Hasidic family. That's why when the hospital's power goes out during a hurricane and she's trapped in an elevator with a stranger, she's horrified. It's a violation of Jewish law for her to be alone with any man who's not her father or another male relative. But this boy, Jackson, who's meant to be a threat to her, he's charming and kind. He's wonderful. Slowly, Devorah lets down her guard. Soon they discover that they're practically neighbors. But on a symbolic level, their worlds couldn't be farther apart. That's because Jackson is black. And in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, where they both live, blacks and Jews don't mix, ever. Still, Devorah is drawn to Jax, and Jax is drawn to Devorah. She knows it's forbidden. She knows that if anyone ever found out that she was seeing him, she would be disowned by her family and cast out of the Hasidic community. The knowledge makes her wistful and angry. So when she realizes that the restaurant where Jax works is just around the corner from her family's pharmacy, it occurs to her she could go there to say hi to him. So when the opportunity presents itself, she does just that. Thus begins Jax and Devorah's forbidden romance. Devorah knows she's risking everything by sneaking around with Jax. She feels guilty and fearful about every single meeting. But loving Jax changes her. Slowly, she begins to question everything about the life that's been laid out for her. Readers can predict that things will not end well for Devorah and Jax. There's no way forward that won't be marred by conflict, strife, and pain. But conflict is an opportunity for Devorah to think on a larger scale about the life she wants for herself, what she gains and what she loses through her religion, what she accepts and what she refuses to give up. Like No Other is certainly a Romeo and Juliet-style romance, but it's something more. Resilience for Devorah is about deciding to be true to herself, no matter what it will cost her. The last book I want to tell you about is the only one in this episode where resilience involves coping with physical tragedy. As readers might imagine, Kelly Bingham's novel Shark Girl tells the story of a devastating event in which main character Jane loses her arm to a shark attack on an ordinary California beach. One minute, she's swimming just a few feet from shore. The next thing she knows, she's an amputee who barely survived the trauma of the attack. What's worse, her private tragedy is now a national news story. Her life captured in newspaper headlines for all the world to see. In the author blurb at the back of the book, Kelly Bingham explains that Shark Girl, the novel, arose directly from the true stories of multiple swimmers who lost limbs to shark attacks during the summer of 2001. As a novel, Shark Girl explores the emotional as well as physical aftershocks of such an event for main character Jane. Before the attack, Jane was an award-winning student artist. Now, as an amputee, Jane wonders if she will ever draw again. Before the attack, Jane's life was her own. Now she is the object of pity for well-meaning strangers all across the country who send her flowers and stuffed animals she calls pity bears. Against her will, Jane has become a celebrity, a victim to some, an inspiration to others. But Jane doesn't want to be a symbol. She just wants her life back. What impressed me the most about Shark Girl and its recently published sequel, formerly Shark Girl, is the intensity of Jane's emotional journey. Both books are novels written in verse, and the poems work beautifully to capture Jane's raw bursts of emotion. Sometimes the emotion is anger, and sometimes it's self-pity. Some days I hate everyone I see, Jane thinks. And then another letter arrives, telling her she is an inspiration in the lives of others. How do you go on living your life when your dreams are wrecked, but suddenly you are the emblem of hope for other people? Here again, it's resilience that provides the answer. I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Next month, I'll be back to weigh in on a professional discussion that's been building over the past calendar year on blog posts by critics and in tweets by librarians. We need diverse books is both a Twitter hashtag and an activist movement in the field of young adult literature. I'll introduce you to its origins, as well as some of the newest books that capture the artistry and the importance of diverse literature for teens. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at www.readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at www.readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening and look forward to more Text Messages soon.